Live from the In the Room studios located in the Net Carrier and Cloud, this is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're staying up late with the VOC Nation on Sunday night. It's 11:30 p.m., so you know that means it's time for Compton After Dark. I'm Dean Compton. I want to thank everybody out there for listening tonight. Thanks if you're listening live. Thanks if you're listening on the podcast. We have the greatest time bringing you the best in wrestling and comic books today, yesterday, possibly the future once we get the M-Theory figured out to utilize time travel technology. And with me, as always, my co-host, Ryan Mays, having a great time as usual. Got to see you a little bit today to watch a little Kansas City Royals baseball.
Yeah, man, big win. What's the matching number now, 19?
19, and the Tigers are playing now. They were ahead last I looked, but if they do manage to lose the game, that magic number will go down to 18. Big series for my beloved and cherished Kansas City Royals coming up this week, starting tomorrow with the Tigers. I will be live tweeting that game at the Anti-Fascist, but I am equally excited about having Mark Arnold here tonight. Great comic book and just historian in general, written for Back Issue Magazine, written several books of his own about, you know, Ryan, Harvey Comics, Disney, Total Television. I could go on and on, but the guy knows his stuff. Crack Magazine, you know, I actually was introduced to Mark through Mort Todd, so definitely excited to hear a lot about Crack Magazine. Maybe he's got a little behind the scenes on Mort that Mort wouldn't tell me, that he'll tell me tonight, and I can utilize it to blackmail Mort later.
Yeah, man, absolutely. I actually know of him from the Shout Factory. He puts out some, like, great box sets of stuff, and I know at least the Underdog one, he did some commentaries on there, so that's really cool.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and that's what I'm talking about, folks. We bring you the best guests possible. If you want to be a part of this tonight, 855-VOC-RADIO, 855-862-7234. I want to talk about one more thing before we take a break. On the other side of the break, we'll be live with Mark Arnold. I want to talk about Guardians of the Galaxy, Ryan. This thing, you know, won't die, won't go away. I love the movie. I'm glad it won't go away. Number one in the box office this weekend.
Hey, man, that's awesome. And, you know, we're obviously comic book nerds, and we're all about the Marvel Universe, you know, doing well, especially the more obscure properties. So, you know, to see it keep staying on top after this long, it just, you know, it raises our hopes for, you know, more strange properties to get their due.
It's really funny because if you recall the months preceding the release, there was this huge worry that nobody would care because these properties, Star-Lord, Rocket Raccoon, Gamora, Drax the Destroyer, you know, were not obviously not mainstream. And I think there were a lot of critics who were saying, well, you can get over Thor and Hulk and Captain America, but no way this will get over. And not only has it gotten over, but it's the most successful movie of the year, easily the biggest movie of the summer, and I think it's the best movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe besides Avengers and the first Iron Man.
Oh, yeah, I've loved it. I mean, if you're any kind of sci-fi fan, I imagine you go the same way. I know before this came out, I was pretty nervous, too, that this might be, you know, the film that marked the point of oversaturation for the Marvel Universe. But, no, it was great. I mean, they're doing a killer job with each phase of their stuff. Their movies are spaced really just perfectly far apart that you're not burnt out on seeing them. By the time another one comes out, you're excited for it. They're killing it.
I think another thing excuse me, folks. I think another thing that they have perfected, and I've mentioned this to you, and I mentioned this to Emily Scott, my co-host of Her Dork World, His Dork World, live at Thursday nights at midnight, right here on VOC Nation as well. And that is they do an excellent job of when you walk out of the theater – for these Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, it feels like you have just turned the last page of a comic book and you've got to know what happens next. You can't wait for that next issue, which a lot of movies don't inspire that feeling, particularly if you know they're going to be a sequel. They've perfected that. It's really astonishing to see that transcend mediums.
Yeah, it feels great. I mean, it makes you want to see what's going to happen next. At the same time, each individual movie stands perfectly well on its own, like start to finish. I would say you don't even have to – I can't think of a single one you necessarily have to have seen, you know, previous Marvel movies to get. They all just function perfectly well as a single and as part of a greater whole.
Yeah, which makes them almost like the perfect comic books in a way. Speaking of comic books, though, we are going to get to a break. On the other side of the break, we'll talk Harvey Comics, Archie Comics, Total Television, The Beatles, lots more with Mark Arnold. You're listening to Compin' After Dark. We're live. This is the VOC Nation. It's worldwide, folks. Worldwide.
Live from the In the Room studios located in the Net Carrier and Cloud, this is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Hey everyone, it is your favorite knockout, Mickey James, and you're listening to the VOC Nation.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Thanks for coming on down. It's Save Wrestling, the podcast, and the business making town. I am your award-winning hostess with the mostest, Shelly Funtime Martinez, and she is my co-host, Dazzling Danielle.
Woo! Hello out there.
And together we are the Martinez Girls. You finally did it. And you can join us here Monday, new time, 6 p.m. Eastern on the VOC Nation as we save wrestling together, Danielle. Fighting crime. Woo!
Hey guys, Brady Hicks here, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributing writer and the host of In the Room, thebradyhicks.com, and for the first time ever, vocnation.com. So happy to be part of the family. Join us each and every Tuesday night, 9, 8 Central, vocnation.com, thebradyhicks.com, myself, DJ, Derek McDonald, Ray Bogus, Anthony Sarlo, Kathy Fitz, breaking down all that's going on in wrestling today. And so much more.
Hey, it's me, the mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. Netcarrier has many great products and services to increase your bottom line. Be sure to ask your Netcarrier representative about our hosted PBX. Call Netcarrier today for a free analysis of your phone bills. 877-255-7733. That's right, 877-255-7733. Call now.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed. The entire building has just collapsed as if a demolition team set off. When you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself and it is not...
We are live with Carmine Confidential.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
Listen to Carmine Confidential. Weekdays at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. VOC Nation Radio Network.
The most polarizing personalities worldwide. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Looking for a DJ? Looking for someone to host your event? Then look no further. Philadelphia's hottest DJ and host, The Voice of Choice. The Voice of Choice has hosted the hottest events in the tri-state area. Book The Voice of Choice for all your karaoke, conventions, and parties. Go to www.vocnation.com for more information or email the Voice of Truth at voc@vocnation.com.
Are you getting lost in the cloud? Is technology moving too fast for you? Find your way at netcarrier.com. Ride the N cloud and soar above your competition.
This is Buggy Nova, your Candyland princess, and I want everyone to know that I love VOCNation.com.
Hey, how's it Mexico, and this is Amy Dumas, but you may know me as Lita. You're listening to the VOC Nation.
Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us through the break. I'm Dean Compton. You're listening to Compton After Dark right here on VOC Nation Worldwide. And I am very pleased to introduce our guest tonight, Mark Arnold, a renowned historian, written lots of great books on Harvey Comics, the Beatles, Total Television, lots of articles for Back Issue Magazine, and as my co-host pointed out, has done some great commentary for DVDs, such as the Underdog DVD for Shout Factory DVDs. Mark, I want to thank you for having the courage and fortitude to venture right here into Compton After Dark tonight. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks.
No, it's a pleasure to have you. Pleasure to have you. Welcome anytime. And I want to start out by talking about something that you wrote that's not as near and dear to my heart as it is to a lot of people, including my girlfriend, my brothers who are listening intently to the show. And that is, you wrote a book about Disney. I guess it's kind of the early days of Disney, cuts off around 85, and that's out right now. People can get that off the Amazon, and that's like one of your more recent works.
Right, yeah. It's the last one that was published. It came out December of last year, just in time for Christmas, and it covers that middle period, because when I grew up in the 70s, and Walt Disney was just a memory, basically, and they kept putting out these kind of cheesy comedies, gimmick comedies and things like that, and, then they put out, like, a few fantasy musicals, like Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and then later, when things came back with Disney, with Eisner and stuff, and they did Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and stuff like that, the middle period from, like, after Walt's death to when Eisner took over, basically, like, oh, yeah, there's that period when something came out, but we ignore all that. And I took it upon myself to write a book about that period, because that's what I grew up with.
Yeah, it's a little bit before my time. But one of the things that's going on right now that Emily wanted me to ask you about was the I guess there's kind of a schism going on between people that want to use more advanced animation techniques and people that want to keep hand-drawing stuff. And I wonder if in your book, if anything, similar started, coming up, because even though technology, seems to pop up real fast, it actually takes a long time to develop. And she was wondering if that schism may have started even back then with certain executives in certain camps or anything.
You mean as far as, like, computer
technology versus the, staying with hand-drawn animation, because that's what, if you look at the early Disney stuff, even right before, I guess, the 66, when your book Frozen and I starts, that was what they brought, was like beautiful, lavish, hand-drawn animation. And some,
right.
When did they, she wants to know, like, when maybe camp started growing to change that, and was there a pushback during the period in your book?
I don't know if maybe initially there's a pushback, but then when it finally happened, strangely enough, Disney got ahead of the curve, because the first film they put out that had a lot of computer effects, it still had a lot of hand-drawn effects, was Tron, and that came out in 1982. And suddenly they're, strangely enough, at the forefront of technology again after, about 15 years. And that led to, like, their next flat animation film was The Black Cauldron, and there is a digital scene in there, too. But they didn't do a full digital film or digitally animated film till after the period of my book, because it was very expensive to do. So, they just did little bits and pieces. But Tron was, like, probably the most grandiose effort they did to – and still a lot of that, like I said, was hand-drawn too.
Amazingly enough, I have never seen Tron. We do a segment on our other show where it's called Dean's Never Seen, because I've never seen a lot of movies that everyone's seen. I have never sat down and watched it. I really should, right?
Well, for the historical value, as far as the two Tron movies, they did the Tron Legacy in recent times, I think about 4 years ago. I think the original Tron beats it as far as, like, a good story. It's a good, solid story. It might be a little bit dated now since, you know, it's 30 years ago. But, you know, I had to watch all these films again. Well, I didn't have to. I did. I watched all these films again. And that one actually holds up surprisingly well. Another person, and I don't have his name, but he's mentioned in the book because I credit him. I met up with him. He actually did an entire book about the making of Tron in the last couple years because, you know, it is kind of an amazing film because it did lead to things, you know, eventually like Toy Story, let's say, that's completely CGI or even effects that are in, like, the current movies now, you know, any of the Marvel films like you're talking about. You know, you couldn't have Guardians of the Galaxy if you didn't have CGI. You'd have some guy in a puppet costume, you know?
I also want to talk about your impending book, and I guess Tomorrow's Publishing is going to be releasing it next year, and it's going to be about Harvey Comics, which you've already you did a fanzine about Harvey Comics, right? That kind of, that got compiled into the Best of the Harvey Harveyville Fun Times. But this is going to be a book, right?
Yeah, this one's like a more formal history. It's probably the most researched history I've ever done because when I started the Harveyville Fun Times way back in 1990, I really just had this idea that I wanted to do a fanzine. And I had a few different ideas, and it was my ex-wife who said, why don't you do Harvey Comics? And I go, oh, that's an idea. Because I thought about Disney, but I knew people that published fanzines, and they said, oh, don't get involved with a Disney fanzine because they watch you, you know. And, you know.
Right.
But the Harvey people pretty much left me alone. I did consult with them, and then I eventually worked with them and stuff like that. So, but over the years, my Harvey history was just like interview here, information here, blah, blah, blah. And finally, when I got the assignment earlier this year by Tomorrow's to do the Harvey Comics Companion, he said, well, take a look at our other companion books. They sent me a copy of the Quality Comics Companion. And he says, model it after that. And I'm looking through this, and I go, wow, this is really well-researched. And it's like my stuff is just kind of like, oh, I asked this guy this question, this guy this question. So now I have to kind of piece it all together, and I'm probably about 90% done with it. I was actually working on it again today. I'm trying to get it done before the end of the year. And, yeah, it's like it's a very strange story but very interesting story, you know, and I've learned stuff that I didn't even know. Well, stuff I already did know, but it's like virtually every Gold and Silver Age artist – worked at Harvey at one point or another, you know. It's like, and most people just ignore Harvey. They just say, oh, it's just that Casper Richie Rich stuff.
You know? Right.
You know, the book is going to say, you know, yes, they did a lot of that, and it's going to talk about a lot of that stuff, but it's also going to talk about, you know, I had to learn basically the history of comics, and Harvey was there right at the beginning with everybody else practically, maybe a couple years later, but
And they were definitely a powerhouse in the early days, days of comics. And I think there's a lot of nooks and crannies of Harvey Comics that get kind of overlooked. For instance, speaking of Tomorrow's, I've been reading the 1960s history, their books, American Comic Book Chronicle, History Chronicles. And I learned, I had no idea that Joe Simon had done, you know, a superhero line for Harvey.
Yeah. And in fact, Joe Simon was a very close friend with Alfred Harvey, the founder of Harvey Comics. And he worked on a number of projects. A lot of them were kind of behind the scenes. Others were very face front, like what you're talking about, the Harvey Thriller series in the 1960s. But, you know, they worked with Jack Kirby, who did Stuntman, and he did Boy Commandos, and he did a few others. Different types of series. Boys Ranch was one that Marvel reprinted later. A lot of them got reprinted by other publishers later on.
Wow, I had no idea because I was aware of Boy Commandos and Boys Ranch, you know, Simon Kirby production. But like you said, since they were reprinted by Marvel and other companies, I honestly, until this moment, did not know they were Harvey Comics.
Yeah. No, originally they were. I mean, the big issue, a lot of them didn't last very long, and so, you know, like Boys Ranch lasted like 6 issues or something like that. Stuntman was only like 2 issues, and so, but like, you know, every so often, you know, Joe Simon would bring Kirby and they'd go over, if they weren't working on their own projects, they'd go over to Harvey because Alfred Harvey just told Joe, he says, you always have a place here, you can always do something. So they did some 3D books for them, they did some adventure books in the late 50s after the Comics Code took effect and they couldn't publish their horror books anymore. They brought all their friends. So people like John Severin, Al Williamson, Frank Frazetta, they all, pitched in and did artwork for Harvey, around that time. But nobody thinks about that. They think about the other stuff they did.
Right. That's something that I wanted to talk about, too, is how, like you said, everybody thinks that, Harvey's, it's the Casper, it's Windy Witch, it's Sad Sack, or it's my personal favorite, Hot Stuff, the Little Devil, that guy rules. I really like him. But, they also did some really hardcore macabre horror comics whose covers were just as grotesque as anything that EC was going to trial for. Well, not
right.
Going to trial, literally, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, now historians mainly claim, from doing all the research, is that the Harvey horror comics are probably the closest in tone and style and even artwork and writing and everything to the ECs. There's a lot of publishers who did horror books, but usually they're just like a quick scare at the end, nothing too exciting. But Harvey really cared about their stories, especially in those horror books. And later ones, I guess they had a sense where they're kind of getting in trouble with the code hadn't started yet, but they're having all the Senate investigations. So the later ones also kind of took after Mad a little bit and got a little sense of humor in it. And so they do a few parodies in the back, similar to like some of the Mad stuff in the later issues. And it's kind of funny. So they did like Tomb of Terror, Witch's Tale, Chamber of Chills, and they had a hero called Black Cat, a female superhero, and then they just remodeled it into Black Cat Mystery and made it into a horror title. It's kind of funny that they do that. But publishers used to do that all the time. It's like,
All the time, that was the status quo.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I said that's what they did all the time. That was the status quo. Like, it happened to the Golden Age Green Lantern. It happened to the Golden Age Daredevil. Like, Golden Age Daredevil, I think, eventually just became, basically a kids' game comic where it's, Daredevil's little pals. Like, how embarrassing must that be? That guy fought giant Hitler, and now he's relegated to hosting the kid pals.
I think they did that with Captain America too. He's Captain America wasn't selling well as a superhero title, so they suddenly made it Captain America's Mysteries or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think they did a little bit with their other titles, like Joe Palooka. Joe Palooka, it didn't go into a horror title, but it became a war title. And he became a military soldier instead of a boxer. Things like that. They'd do that to morph it to work for whatever they needed to, whatever genre was popular. So.
Was that mostly in those times, since you've done a little bit of research about this as of late, was that mostly to avoid the pay that what it would cost to register a new title, which from what I understand was prohibitively expensive at the time? Was it just for that, or was it also they didn't want to lose the guys who were buying the issues for Captain America or Alan Scott?
No, it's mainly what you first said. Yeah, I talked to Alan Harvey, who's the son of the original founder, before, and he said, all that was for second-class mailing privileges, so they didn't have to get a new permit. They continued on with the same title with the new, it's somewhere dramatic, I mentioned, I said Boy Commandos, I meant to say Boy Explorers, but that was the Simon Kirby thing. But Boy Explorers, they did two issues, and then suddenly it became Milton Caniff's Terry and the Pirates. With issue three. and then Boy Explorers was a back feature in the back of the book. And, that was the, extreme one. But usually it was kind of like what I said, about the Black Cat. The Black Cat started off as a female superhero, and then it became Black Cat Western, when Western became, the genre. And then it came back to being the superhero, and then it became Black Cat Mystery. And then when the Comics Code came into effect, they called it Black Cat Mystic for a while, and I think they brought back the Western title for a while, and then they brought it back to the superhero again when superheroes took off in the 60s, and they finally canceled it. But, it went 65 issues or something, just jumping around, and it's kind of hard to follow. Before things like the internet or even the comic book price guide, it's you didn't know if you had all the issues or not.
Right. Because you just see number 7, it's All-Star Western or whatever, and you're like, wait, where did this even come from?
Yeah, and then, like, EC was probably the worst. You know, Weird Science starts with, like, number 12, and it was, like, I don't know it by heart. You know, it was, like, Happy Hula Hands or something, or Fat and Flat or some title like that. It's like, where did that come from?
Talk to me a little bit about where your love for Harvey Comics comes from, because I know they're the big sellers historically, but in my time, and I'm going to be 35 in a few weeks, it was something that was kind of, you know, not really anything we thought about, except for when I think Archie licensed them for a little bit. But other than that, it wasn't anything that I was ever exposed to. So it'd be interesting, I think, for me and the listeners to hear some of, you know, where you got in touch with these guys.
Yeah, well, I can see exactly why you never really were exposed to them, because I'll say the end of the story first, and then I'll go backwards.
Right on.
So there's a lot of litigation with the family and, you know, different things, which I'm going to cover really in depth in the book. But basically, everything, because of different lawsuits and everything kind of stopped in 1982. And, you know, if you're collecting comics after that, well, they didn't come back until, like, 1986. And it was very slow. And then they went away again in 94, and they really have never been back since. So that's the end of the story as far as the comics, which is probably why I get. Since, you know, I'm 47, so I'm a little bit older. You know, I was exposed to them in the early 70s. You saw them all over the place. They were never regarded as fine literature or anything by anybody. They were never really collected. You know, even in the early 70s, Marvel and DC were king.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but, you know, I collected everything. So it's like I collected, you know, Archie and Charlton and Dennis the Menace and everything. You know, it's like, and, you know, over time, you know, I got curious about certain things. Archie started giving the credits on their comics even, and but Harvey never did, and it's like all the characters had the same basic model. It was like a big head with a little tiny body, and they all had the same facial structure, and it just kind of was like, this is really bizarre. Who draws these things? Where do these come from? Well, why are they here? And, I've always kind of done that, you know, where I'm kind of investigating, you know, like if somebody else had written this major book about Harvey years ago, I probably would have never even bothered to write anything about it because it's done. I'll just read this guy's book. But, you know, in doing the research, like I'm trying to find anything pre, like, 1985, let's say, you know. And there's, I don't know if you're familiar, there used to be this old fanzine that was published in the 70s called The Comic Reader. And they were about the only one who ever talked about Harvey at all. And the earliest article I can find in that was from, like, 1978. And it was kind of this puff piece written by the editor at the time, Sid Jacobson. And he basically said, oh, yeah, we sell millions of comics and Richie Rich is great. And it didn't really explain anything about their history. It kind of mentioned a few names which didn't mean anything to me or anything like that, you know.
Here's some stuff.
Go ahead.
I was like, he's like, here's some stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, even doing the research now, there aren't any articles way, way back. It's like, it was just all, oh, yeah, there's this other publisher, Harvey, you know. And if they went in any depth of the old stuff, prior to Caster and Richie Rich, it was like they might talk about Sad Sack, Black Cat, and maybe like some oddball creations that came out at the time, like The Man in Black or something like that. But, you know, The Spirit of 76 or, you know, really obscure Golden Age superheroes, you know, and that's about it. And so, and you know, my dad, he used to read comics as a kid. I used to ask him, did you ever read Harvey's? And he goes, only if I traded for him. You know, it was never like that. I said, well, what did you buy when you were a kid? I said, well, Marvel wasn't, in his opinion, other people would say boo, but we were talking about the 1940s. He said, in his opinion, he didn't think Marvels were any good. They're timelies then. He said he read all the Fawcett books like Captain Marvel, and he read the DC books like Superman and stuff like that, and later the ECs. And then he kind of got out of comics until I came along. But, you know, it's like, he said, you didn't want to read Archie. Archie stunk. And I go, Archie was pretty good. But, you know, I've seen the 40s reprints. I could see that Archie's in the 40s are kind of hard to take sometimes. you know, but
what about them specifically? It's hard to take for my listeners who haven't been able to get a hold of, I guess, what was it, Pimp Comics number 20 or what have you.
Which one, number 20?
I was saying Pep Comics number 20. I just guessed the Pep Comics number.
Oh, you mean like the first Archie appearance?
Yeah, like the first Archies, you know, like you're saying they were hard to take. Like, what about them specifically? Because a lot of people have not ever seen any of the first Archies.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I never even saw them. I had a couple scattered issues, and I always just thought, oh, Archie is really cool. It's always been cool, and I'm an Archie fan, too. I tend to like the stuff from the 50s and 60s the best. Dark Horse started reprinting them in these hardback volumes in the last few years, and that's where I started reading them. And I go, wow, some of these stories are really strange, and they're not very funny. You know, occasionally there's ones that are funny, but overall it's like, it's just kind of cute is the best way to describe it. And it's like, you know, some people might dismiss all of Archie and say, it's all the same, you know, but it's like, you know, even now, it's like the death of Archie, at least they're trying, or life, afterlife with Archie, at least they're trying to do something different. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask you your opinion on that. We've had Paul Kupferberg on the show, really nice guy, and the story was really good, you know, as far as life with Archie. And like you said, people kind of say, oh, you read one Archie, you read them all, but I don't know that any publisher has pushed boundaries. And in a good way, not just pushing them to push them, but push boundaries to tell great contemporary stories and age their characters as well as Archie has in, say, the last, you know, 5 years, 7 years.
Yeah, well, that's about the time they started doing it, but I think it's because they had the old guard. I mean, now they're in the third generation, and so, you know, they're trying to, you know, boost sales and kind of say, we have to stop just doing all these Archie chases Betty and Veronica, Jughead eats hamburgers, you know, whatever, and, you know, playing the Archie's band, you know, you've got to do something a little bit different here, you know.
Right.
I used to send them scripts like in the early 90s, and I've been telling people this recently. I'm not claiming anything. It's just that I sent some sample script ideas, and one of them they used recently, but not in the same way, but is the death of Archie. And I submitted him a spec script back in sometime, I think it was after the Superman death issue back then, and I said, you know, in my story, he wasn't shot. Sorry if I spoiled that for anybody who hasn't read it. But in my story, you know, Archie didn't really die. He just goes missing, but everybody thinks he dies and he has a funeral and da-da-da-da-da. That was my basic story. Victor Gorelick, who's actually still editor over there, he sent it back and he goes, this is too way out. We can't do this. And then I had another story. I don't remember all the stories. I sent in like six different spec scripts. So one of them was Jughead becomes a vegetarian. Yeah, because he's always eating hamburgers. And they just said, no, can't do that. And they still haven't done that one. So if they, you know, if Victor's listening, you can still do it. You know, I'll be ready to write the script for you.
hey, you never can tell. And, you know, hey, if they're willing to do what they've done with life with Archie, I mean, hey, why can't Jughead be a vegetarian? I mean, they tell zombie stories now. Jughead can eat
quinoa. Yeah, 10 years ago, the zombie thing, oh, yeah, they used to have a title, Life with Archie. You know, of course, in the magazine called Life with Archie. And, you know, it would be a joke, just like, wouldn't it be funny if they did Afterlife because zombies are popular? You know, and it's like, it would just be like, in the old days, that would be a joke somebody would think of. They wouldn't even think of actually doing it, but nowadays, Archie's actually doing it. So.
And you worked on an Archie book, according to Amazon, right? Archie, A Celebration of America's Favorite Teenagers?
Yeah, I did. Craig Yeo is a friend of mine. He publishes a lot of books under the imprint Yeo Books for IDW. And when he was working on that book, he just found it a little bit overwhelming because they have a lot of history, too. And he was reaching out to different people that had written about Archie. And when I started my Harvey fanzine, I had considered doing an Archie one. But then this other person started one around the same time, and it was just called the Archie fanzine or Archie Comics fanzine or something. So I actually wrote for that, and that lasted about 10 years or something like that. And in the back of my mind, I always thought, oh, I'll do an Archie book. And Craig kind of beat me to it, but at least he allowed me to work on it. And, you know, I submitted some material for it. I helped him edit it. And I thought it came out pretty well. So,
So buy the book, folks. You can find it on Amazon. Yeah. And like I said, it's Archie, A Celebration of America's Favorite Teenagers. And when it comes to these type of comic books, we're talking about Harvey, we're talking about Archie. Is there, because these aren't, you know, my super favorite trainings, like I said, like you said, the timeline doesn't work for me to get exposed to a lot of Harvey. And I liked Archie, but I really liked Archie mostly when I was young. I don't know why, but I loved reading Archie when I was like 6 or 7. Is there kind of, when it comes to the fan culture of these two, kind of a schism between them? Because they're kind of the safe, friendly books that lasted the longest. You know, and I wonder if that spurs any of that because, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars people, that kind of nonsense.
Do you mean why are they still popular? Or what, I'm not sure what you mean, but...
I mean... When it comes to fans of these books, is there enmity between the fan bases? Because like they're like, these are the real family-friendly books. They're like, these are. Because in other elements of these cultures, like when you go to cons, people draw lines between themselves. Like, you got to be a Star Wars guy or a Star Trek guy. Since these are the family-friendly books that seem to last the longest, I'm just asking about the culture of the fan base, if you're aware. And I don't know if it's true or even if you're aware. It's just something that's interesting to me.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. I mean, it's like, I'll admit, I'll say the United States, and then I'll say for other countries, because it's different. In the United States, basically, superheroes are king. And basically, it's Marvel, DC, Image, and Dark Horse, I guess, you know, and that's it. You know, it's like, and everything else is just, oh, that's kid stuff, or it's not that important, or whatever. And, you know, so as far as fandom goes, you know, if some hot Marvel artist or something appears at a convention, or even an old-time guy, you know, say like Neil Adams or something, you know, or Jim Steranko, you know, it's like, yeah, he'll have a line around the block. But, you know, I mentioned Sid Jacobson, the editor. Yeah, I mean, if they say Sid Jacobson's showing up. He edited Harvey Comics for like 30, 40 years, and he also did Marvel Star Comics. There'd be like crickets in the room, like when Daffy Duck comes out on the stage. You know, it's like me. I think one of the best artists ever is basically unknown, and he is a Harvey artist. It's Warren Kremer, and was very versatile. Now his main thing is he drew Casper and he drew Richie Rich, yes, and he also drew some hot stuff and Little Audrey and Little Dot and da 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 da. He did a lot, but what people don't know is he did virtually all the covers. Like, Joe Palooka was a strong-selling title for a number of years. They weren't drawn by the cartoonist Tam Fisher. They were drawn by Warren Kremer. Those horror comics, all the covers were laid out by Warren Kremer. Now, other artists that did get credit, like Lee Elias, Howard Nostrand, and a few others, Al Avison, they took Kremer's layouts and put the covers on there. So, like, there's this one famous one, Black Cat Mystery. You may or may not have seen it. Issue number 50, and it has this guy holding a piece of radium, and his face is melting off. Well, it's been attributed to both Lee Elias and Warren Kremer, and actually, both would be correct, because Warren did the layouts for it and drew it, and then basically Lee took it and inked it and made the final cover. So, yes, they both worked on it, so... You know, but this is the same guy who's doing Casper the Friendly Ghost, and they go, oh, how could he do that horror stuff, you know? It's, like, very versatile, that's why.
Does it amaze you, kind of, you know, when you were growing up collecting the Harvey comics, like you said, they were kind of apparently eschewed by people, like your dad said, I only read them if I traded for them. But some of those characters, Casper, Richie Rich, they're entrenched in popular culture to this day. Like, if some kid shows up with any kind of bling anywhere, that kid's Richie Rich to just about everybody around him. Does it amaze you the dichotomy between how that's come about versus how these characters were perceived when you were in your heyday collecting?
Well, they were always kind of maligned even then, you know. It's like they just were being published. That's the difference, you know. At least, like I said, in the United States. Like in Europe, I'll use Europe for example. Like here, Here, like the Donald Duck comics, let's say, or Uncle Scrooge, they're revered. Some people know Karl Barks and maybe Don Rosa, but like Don Rosa, he'll go to Europe and he'll get the big lines, just like a Stan Lee would here. You know, he's considered an icon over there. He drew the life and times of Scrooge McDuck. He's my hero. But Europe is different that way. They like non-superhero stuff that's just different. They like Asterix the Gaul, and they like Tintin. You know, it had a movie that came out here, but they were kind of hesitant to bring it out here because they didn't know how it would go over. It did well, but, you know, it's like the superhero movies, like the Marvel ones, they still do a lot better. So it's like it's the same thing. But then you go, like, Japan, they like all that stuff too, but then they like their manga and the anime stuff, you know, which here, you know, there's a cult for that here, but it's nowhere near it is over there.
Well, over in Japan, it seems, and my friends, you know, I have several friends actually that are big manga and anime fans. It's just comic books are a more acceptable medium, animation as well, in that of course you'd read a comic book about a baseball player, just like you might watch a baseball movie or read a baseball novel. While here, I don't know that you could market a baseball comic.
No. yeah, it wouldn't go over very well. I mean, there's a few publishers now that publish a few things, but I don't know how well they do. I mean, like even DC, you know, they have the rights to, like, all the Hanna-Barbera characters now through Warner Brothers. Do they publish a full line of Hanna-Barbera comics? No, they publish Scooby-Doo, and that's it. You know, they could be publishing, and I know they've tried. They put out Flintstones and Jetsons and all that stuff in the past, but, you know, they just figure, not that important. And then they even have homegrown things. DC used to publish a full line in the 40s and 50s. They used to have Peter Porkchops and Flippity and Flop and Sugar and Spike and all these different kid comic books. And, you know, I always think, wow, they have, like, free stuff to just reprint, and they don't even bother with it because they figure, that's not our audience anymore. I don't know.
Oh, go on.
I just say I buy it. You know, they did put out a Sugar and Spike archive edition a couple years ago, but I guess I don't know if it sold well or not because they only did one volume and that was it. So,
well, also now, like, you know, they're owned by Time Warner, and they have the rights to all the Cartoon Network stuff. And I used to work for Turner, which, you know, I worked for Cartoon Network. And they used to publish comics based on that, but now they farm that out. It makes no sense to me. You have a comic book company in your corporation. Why would you ever have to like Dexter's Laboratory? If you're going to do a comic and make money, you should make it in-house.
Yeah. I don't know. I really don't.
I'm just chatting, you know. I mean, it's baffling.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, it's funny. For years, I wanted them to put out a Looney Tunes comic because I knew they owned Bugs Bunny. They finally did. But now they publish it, and it's reprints every issue. And it's like, you know, I have all the old issues. And, you know, back in the 70s when Gold Key had all those titles, they had a Daffy Duck title, there's a Bugs Bunny title, there's a Yosemite Sam title, the Porky Pig title. They had a title for every character, and it's like... I don't know if all those titles would sell, but it just seems amazing to me that it's just one title, you know?
And you go back a little further, and Dell was the number one comic book publisher, you know, in America because of the strength of stuff like their Looney Tunes and Disney comics.
Right.
So, I mean, there could definitely be a market for it, but it just seems like one. I think you kind of brushed against it where they're like, that's not really our demographic anymore. That's not what we do. And they feel like these are safer sales, I guess. That's my conjecture anyway. I don't know.
Basically, you know, going back to Harvey, they haven't published Harveys in 20 years, except for the occasional, like when the Casper movie came out. There was a Casper movie adaptation. Of course, these are now not published by Harvey, so that one was published by Marvel. And, they started a Harvey magazine. You know, they just kind of put little stuff here and there. And I think the big problem with all this stuff, and then in recent times, they did revive a Richie Rich series about three or four years ago. and they kind of tried to update it and everything like that. And overall, I don't know if it sold well, because you kind of alienate the people that want it the old way, and the new people are just like, what is this? And, you know, and the publisher seems to want to expect it. Well, this has got to sell as well as the top-selling Marvel and DC titles. And when they don't, they just kind of shrug their shoulders, and then they go, oh, you know, but I've always said this for years. It's like, it's not going to sell like Marvel and DC. It's a different type of audience, you know. You have to market it different. Like, Archie, going back to them, the reason why they survive all these years is not really because of Life with Archie or After Life with Archie or Archie's death. Really, it's those digests that they put in the grocery stores. You know,
absolutely.
The impulse buys. You know, so
yeah, they're the only comic book
you
can still buy at Walmart or Kroger or a grocery store.
I've said that for years. It's like, if you want to bring back Harvey's or any of these kid comics, make digests and put them at the checkout stand at the grocery store, and people will buy them. You know, it's like, and they haven't done them, you know.
Well, they should call you. I don't know why they won't listen.
I'm giving
Talking
away my
Mark,
ideas for free.
I know. You should have kept it. It's out on the airwaves now, though. Somebody's writing it down on, like, a yellow legal pad, circling it twice.
You got to be patient with those things, because what they'll do is they'll put it out, and it won't sell, like, millions and zillions of dollars, you know. Even though they're all reprints, you don't have to pay any artists and writers, and they'll say, oh, that's a failure, and then they'll close up shop after two or three issues. And it's like, no, it's a different type of item, you know. It's like, you know,
another thing is, I think that it's also, like, early expectations are just kind of unreal in that, you know, I mean, if you put out three or four issues, that's really not enough to build up the word of mouth. I mean, to get better sales.
Right.
You're right. They probably couldn't get Marvel or DC sales, but they could probably be doing better a year down the line by just sticking with it a little bit and trying to promote their product instead of just throwing in the towel. It seems like it just seems that way to me.
Right. And then you can go into the whole topic of digital comics or something, and it's like, where are the digital comics of all these things? You know, it's like, you know. I think Archie has an app, and I've seen a couple other apps, like Kaboom does one for, like, Peanuts and Garfield and a couple other comic strip publications that they do. But in general, you know, there's a lot of stuff that they could be putting out that they don't, and I don't understand why.
I mean, we can conjecture on it all night long, and it sounds, Mark, like you and I got the answers. Like, if they would just listen to us a little more, maybe check out Compton After Dark here on the VOC Nation, we could tell them what's up. But as it is, we'll have to take a commercial break instead right now. You guys,
okay.
We're talking with Mark Arnold tonight, live, right here on the VOC Nation. You want to be a part of this, 855-VOC Radio, 855-862-7234. Been talking a lot about Harvey Comics, definitely going to talk, you know, more about that. We'll talk some Cracked Magazine, as Mark wrote two books about Cracked Magazine, and we'll talk Total Television Productions, but we're not going to talk about it until after this break. I'm Dean Compton, Compton After Dark, VOC Nation, worldwide.
Live from the In the Room studios located in the Net Carrier and Cloud, this is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Hey guys, Brady Hicks here, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributing writer and the host of In the Room, thebradyhicks.com, and for the first time ever, VOCNation.com. So happy to be part of the family. Join us each and every Tuesday night, 9, 8 Central, VOCNation.com, thebradyhicks.com, myself, DJ, Derek McDonald, Ray Bogus, Anthony Sarlo, Kathy Fitz, breaking down all that's going on in wrestling today.
Hi, this is Anthony.
And this is Gartiz.
We are the forces of radio.
The faces for radio.
Come relax with us every Thursday at 5:30. We love hosting Feces for Radio.
That's Faces for Radio. Can you please remember to get the name of the show right?
Sorry. We tackle sports, entertainment, and have a kick-ass soundboard. Erasers for Radio has it all.
Faces for Radio. Are you doing this on purpose?
Why?
You can find us on the VOCNation.com, listen to us live, or download it later. Follow us on Twitter at Faces for Radio 1. That's Faces for Radio.
funky for radio. Shut up.
The most polarizing personalities worldwide. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Looking for a DJ? Looking for someone to host your event? Then look no further. Philadelphia's hottest DJ and host, The Voice of Choice. The Voice of Choice has hosted the hottest events in the tri-state area. Book The Voice of Choice for all your karaoke, conventions, and parties. Go to www.vocnation.com for more information or email The Voice of Choice at voc@vocnation.com.
Are you getting lost in the cloud? Is technology moving too fast for you? Find your way at netcarrier.com. Ride the N-Cloud and soar above your competition.
Business owners, prepare to take charge. Get the latest trends in business and technology every Tuesday at 12 p.m. Eastern, presented by NetCarrier. Tweet your business questions in advance at NetCarrier using the hashtag TakeChargeTuesday. Or call live toll-free at 855-VOC-RADIO.
Hello, this is ECW Original, former WWE superstar, the Blue Meanie. This is D'Lo Brown. You better recognize this. If you are looking to do any kind of autograph session, personal or private, with the greatest in professional wrestling, people always ask me, Blue Meanie, how can I have you on my show? Well, if you'd like to have myself, the BWO, or anybody else, you don't need to go any further than WrestlingMarks.com. Just go to WrestlingMarks.com. Drop him a line, give him a call. My boy Eric will take care of you right away. Now recognize that, partner.
Hey, welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us through the break. I'm Dean Compton. You're listening to Compton After Dark right here on the VOC Nation Worldwide. You want to be a part of the show tonight and talk to Mark Arnold, 855-VOC-RADIO, 855-862-7234. You can also reach us via email, ComptonAfterDark@gmail.com, and we're on Facebook, facebook.com/ComptonAfterDark. Been talking a lot of Harvey comics with Mark Arnold. He did put together a fanzine that was then collected in the Best of the Harveyville Fun Times, available via Amazon. And the Harvey Companion will be coming out next year sometime. Do you know a date on that?
No.
I guess it
just
depends on when you get it done.
Yeah, basically. I told the publisher late 2015 because I'm also working on another book, which I got the assignment to do two different books at the exact same time. One was the Harvey book, and the other is this book about the Patty Freeland Company, which did the Pink Panther. And I've never gotten an assignment to do two books exactly at the same time, and so I'm like, how do I do that? And then I said, you know, I'll write one of them first, and then I'll write the other one, because, you know, it's hard for me to shift gears like that. There's just too much research and stuff involved, so pretty much the latter half of last year and to the first half of this year, I worked on the Patty Freeling book, and it's basically sitting, although there's a couple people proofing it right now, and I'm hoping that'll come out early next year. And then the Harvey one I'm writing now, and I'm hoping to get that done by the end of this year so it can come out late next year, but, you know, it could go into 2016. I hope it doesn't go that late, but, you know, these things seem to take forever to come out.
That's the old writer's curse, though, right there. You know, it's either feast or famine. Either nobody wants you to write anything or everybody wants you to write everything.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and then on occasion, you know, you mentioned back issue. You know, I've gotten fewer back issue assignments just out of pure, I don't know, luck of the draw or something like that, but which is fine because I'm working on this other stuff. But the biggest project that I work for them will be coming out about January. They wanted to do an article about Robert Crumb's Weirdo magazine that came out like in the late 80s, early 90s. And I interviewed, you know, originally I was just saying, oh, I'll just interview a couple people. And then, you know, it just kind of escalated because, you know, it was kind of a contributor magazine where, you know, they had different artists and writers in every issue, and it lasted 28 issues. And so, I go, wow, if I'm going to go this far, I might as well just get everybody. And I actually got all the big people, you know, that I wanted. And so I talked to Drew Friedman, and I talked to Bill Griffith, and, you know, some in person like Bill Griffith. And then I actually, through tracking it down and some help, I got Robert Crumb's email, and he's in France with his family, and he actually sent me some really nice answers. He really cared. And, you know, I go, wow, this is going to make the article. So that's going to come out in January. You
oh,
know,
that's
because
awesome.
Once I got him, then everybody says, oh, I'm on board, you know. And so it's like, so.
Yeah, that's awesome because, I mean, from what I, you know, obviously, you know, I only know what people tell me, but, you know, sometimes it can be hard to get a hold of Robert Crumb, you know, and I mean, it would be hard to do this project, really do it justice without having at least some input from him. So that's awesome.
Right. But I didn't know what he's like, you know, because it's like, you know, I've seen the movie Crumb, but, you know, it's like he moved off to France and, you know, is he a recluse? He doesn't like to talk to anybody. I don't know what he's like. And,
right.
You know, when I finally got to track him down, he wrote back probably like a month after I wrote him on an email. And he was really apologetic. He's all, oh, I'm sorry. I don't check my email that often, but, you know, I really want to help you with this. What's your deadline? And I told him. And then, like, 3 days later, I gave him some questions by email. And then, like, 3 days later, he wrote these really wonderful, lengthy answers that said exactly what I wanted. So it's like, you know. You know, I couldn't have asked for anything more because it's some people, you've done it yourself. You interview somebody, and it's like, how was it to work on this book? I don't know. You know, it was a job, whatever, 20 years ago. I don't remember. It's like, and you're like, I still have an hour and a half left on this show. Talk.
Right. You're like, yeah. You know, that does happen. I can't, I don't want to name names or whoever it was, but I asked this long question about, you know, 70 or early 80s Daredevil. And the answer I got was, yeah, I worked on that, and that was good. Like, you know, I was like, oh, my goodness. Like, it was like a four-sentence question. It was very funny, you know. I mean, I just wound up laughing, making a joke out of it. But, yeah, that's the thing. You never know how people are going to be, especially people with reputations. And Robert Crumb certainly, you know, has one. But I'm glad to hear that it's sort of ill-received, if you will.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't know if he, you know, because you see his artwork, I didn't know if he was going to be really strange or what, you know, it's like, you never know, you know, and sometimes, I'll have to admit, sometimes the people who are the strangest in their artwork are like the most down-to-earth normal people. They get all their strange and weirdness out on paper, and then behind the scenes, they're basically fine, you know, it's like...
It's probably also hard, you know, when you do those strange and weird things to be an artist, you know, for a living. Then when you're not, you know, doing your living stuff, you're like, I'm just going to sit here and be cool, you know. Like I told you when we were off the air, I work as a master control operator, which means, folks, I'm constantly surrounded by TV screens. So when I get home, usually the last thing I want to do is watch television. I'm like, I think I'll just sit here and read a book, you know. So that probably ties into it, too. You're like, ah, that's work. Let me just be normal
right.
for a moment. I want to talk to you a little bit more about Harvey Comics because we touched upon
sure.
something earlier when you said that Joe Simon would always have a place there, and that was the kind of place that Harvey Comics was. Talk to me about the kind of place Harvey Comics was in the 40s, 50s, 60s when Joe Simon would be welcomed back. Was it a really nice place to work in an industry that was known for not having very nice places to work, or were they just good to Joe Simon? Because I'm learning as much as anybody else here. I don't know a whole lot about Harvey Comics, so I'm just – I mean, this is just fascinating to me.
Yeah. Well, the impression I've gotten doing the research is and I didn't even know this until I did the book. A lot of work in both comic books and animation in those years tended to be kind of seasonal. And, you know, people like to work all year round. So, you know, they would go around and, you know, work for a few months, and then the work would be done. Like, they'd do a year's worth of work in about 6 months. And
right.
So... They'd let everyone go. They'd all be freelance, and they'd be scrambling around looking for their next job because they need 6 months more to work. So Harvey was one of the first publishers. I don't know if it was the only publisher, but it was one of the first publishers that tended to work all year round. and they had low page rates, but at least they, you know, so in an interview with Sid Jacobson, you know, he said, yeah, it's like, you know, people would call me back and it's like, hey, do you have any work? Yeah, I have some work, you know, I'm not going to pay a lot, but I have some work, and they go, I'll take it, you know, it's like that.
Right.
And for Joe Simon, yeah, it's like, it seemed like whenever he was kind of like in a little bit of a lull with his career, you know, a lot of times he was with Jack Kirby, and especially in the early days, like, he had Captain America, and then he had his issues with the ownership of it, and so they left, Timely, I would call it Marvel, but it's really Timely back then, and, you know, they went to Harvey, and the very first official Harvey comic, which is a pocket-sized digest called Pocket Comics, ironically, Joe Simon did the cover for it. You know, so he was there at the beginning. And then he and Kirby went on to do other things, you know, working for the other publishers. And then when things got slow, they came back, and I said, like, they did 3D book. They did Captain 3D. They did a few other ones. I don't have them all at the tip of my tongue. And then they left a few years. Simon and Kirby published their own books under their own imprint for a while, and then that went belly up, and then the last thing I think Simon and Kirby worked on, if I remember correctly, it was something for Archie. It was not Archie. It was like The Private Life of Henry Strong or some obscure title like that, and at that point, Simon and Kirby parted ways. They didn't become enemies. It's just that Stan Lee embraced Kirby again to develop, like, you know, the Marvel stuff, Fantastic Four and everything else. So Kirby was out of commission for Simon. And so Simon, at that time, he developed Sick Magazine, which is a Mad Magazine ripoff. And he did a few other things. And then, like we said before, he came back into these thriller titles that, you know, I've read differing accounts that actually those thriller titles initially had Stan Lee concerned because they go, oh, my God, here's somebody, you know, that, you know, knows what he's doing. He's been in the business a long time like me. And then the thing was basically a total flop. You know, they had a few good things that came out of it, like the Harvey, Simon was able to convince Will Eisner to bring back the Spirit. And so it's the first, you know, I guess modern day or Silver Age, I'll say, whatever, version of the Spirit. And that led to the version published by Kitchen Sink and Warren and everybody else and, you know, the movie and all that stuff. So, but prior to that, you know, the Spirit was kind of dormant. You know, Eisner really wasn't working in comics anymore and things like that. And
I think these titles I'll go on.
Excuse me? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to tell you that the title that you were looking for a second ago was The Double Life of Private Strong.
The
Joe Simon, Jack Kirby production. And then they actually worked together later at DC on that 70s Sandman. But
okay,
I think
that you did that. I forgot about that, you know.
No. I'm not trying to make you look silly. I just got to tell the listeners, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, I don't want false information out there.
Yeah,
but it was so short-lived, it's easy to forget about, especially amidst everything else Kirby was doing at DC at the time.
Right. And, you know, other things that Joe Simon did that I discovered and I didn't know is he would, in the 70s, they put out, like, a really bizarre thing, like a Richie Rich Book of Fractions. Yeah, and I finally got a copy of this thing, and I was looking at it, and I said, this is the weirdest Richie Rich artwork I've ever seen. And I discovered it was Joe Simon's artwork. They didn't get the regular artist, Warren Kremer, or anybody else to do it. They got Joe Simon to do it because it was, you know, it wasn't a comic book, and it was, you know, so he did a capable job, but it definitely doesn't look like the standard artist that they have. It was, you know, a little more sketchy than, you know, the typical stuff.
Yeah.
And so... And in the 70s also, there's a big push with Casper and the Cub Scouts. And in the issues, if you look at any of the issues from the 70s, they used to have photos. Well, the photographer for all those photos was Joe Simon. I was like, he didn't get credit for any of that stuff, but he was there. They would go to parades and stuff like that, and Alfred Harvey got his kids to wear the costumes, and you know, because they were kids then. And they dress up as Casper and Richie Rich and even Wendy. You know, and parade around in these costumes that must have weighed a ton because, you know, I've actually seen the real costume and put, like, the Richie Rich head on my head. And as a full-size adult, that's a heavy, heavy head. And these kids apparently got bruising on their shoulders and everything, carrying the weight of this giant head on their shoulders.
Oh, my gosh. That's insane. Yeah. like I could just hear a child being like, you know, Mom, the Richie Rich head is hurting me. You know, like just something surreal like that.
Yeah. There's no such thing as child abuse. It's like, shut up and keep marching. You're doing this for free comics. You're doing a public service here. Okay.
I'm fine. You're going to get extra candy. That's what you really would do with bribery. That's what I do with my niece and nephew. I'm like, I'll just figure out something to give them because, you know, that's the way you get things done with kids, I think. And speaking of, you know, I wanted to switch gears and talk about Total Television a little bit because you also wrote a book about them, you know, you created and produced by Total Television Productions. And I was unaware until I started looking into this that they did like Cocoa Puff commercials, you know, talk about bribing kids. But if you could talk a little bit about the history of Total Television, you know, because I just had no idea they were behind so much. Underdog, Commander McGregg, Tennessee Tuxedo, Go Go Gophers. I'm learning so much from this show, and that's what I love the most about getting to do this, man.
Well, the story behind that, I'll jump back to when I started my fanzine. One of the inspirations for my fanzine was this one called The Frostbite Falls Far-Flung Flyer. And I contacted the guy named Charles Ulrich. I don't even know if he's still around. He must be. But, you know, I said, yeah, how many subscribers do you have? And he goes, like a couple hundred. And I go, really? And it was like this little, you know, mimeograph thing that he was talking about Rocky and Bullwinkle and everything. And it was stapled in the corner, printed on colored paper, and he just mailed it out. And this was like in the late 80s. And I go, wow, I should do one of these, you know. And so I always was a big Rocky and Bullwinkle fan. But I noticed when you watch the shows on TV, they'd sometimes put like Tennessee Tuxedo or Commander McBragg, and they go, well, these aren't Rocky Bullwinkle or made by Jay Ward. That's who was the maker of them. I go, what are these about? And then this guy who actually ended up voicing Bullwinkle, I think, for the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie, Keith Scott, he wrote this book called, I can't even think of the name of his book. I should know this off the top of my head, but, you know, I'll look it up while I'm talking. But The Moose That Roared, there we go. And his book is an excellent book about the history of J. Ward Productions. It talks about Rocky and Bullwinkle and George of the Jungle and Super Chicken, Tom Slick, Coppity Hooper, all the stuff they did. And then he kind of makes scant reference to Underdog and Tennessee Tuxedo. Oh, yeah, there's this other company called Total Television, and they, you know, they made unfunny cartoons like Underdog. And, you know, and I'm like, what? I like, I cartoons. You know, they weren't written the same way as Rocky and Bullwinkle. Rocky and Bullwinkle is certainly kind of sophisticated, whereas, you know, the Total Television stuff is very straightforward. And so in the back of my mind, I was just always kind of thinking about it. It's like, who made these cartoons? And when you watch, like, Underdog or any of those, there's no credits at the end except for the people who did the voices. And there's, like, this mysterious animation studio called Gamma Animation. And I knew that name from Keith Scott's book and from Rocky and Bullwinkle. And so I said, well, there's a connection here somehow. I don't understand where. And before I started writing for Back Issue, I used to write for this other publication, which is still around, called Hogan Valley. And
That comes out of Decatur, real close to here.
Yeah, and it comes out like once a year. I think it took 2 years to do the last issue. So Tom Leitch has called me up and said, well, is there anything you'd like to write about? And I go, you know, I'm always curious about this studio that did Underdog. I never knew anything about it. And so he says, well, if you can find out anything, write an article. And the only thing I had to go on is there's a magazine called Animato who interviewed this guy named Joe Harris. And so I said, well, that's a step in the right direction. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And I finally found the guys who were the four original owners. One of them's passed away now, but his name was Buck Biggers. And then there's a guy named Chet Stover, and then Joe Harris was the animator. And then there's this other guy named Fred Covington. He was, like, the business guy. And, you know, Chet and Buck, they were, like, the writers. And they wrote, and Buck wrote all the songs. So all the theme songs, everybody knows, he wrote all those. I didn't know any of this until I interviewed him, because their names aren't on the shows. And I asked him, why didn't you put your names on the show? And he goes, because we didn't want to be like Walt Disney hogging all the credit. Total Television was the name of the thing, and, you know, that's what we're going to give credit to. And I go, well, it certainly makes it hard for doing research if you're not the one who worked on these things. You know, but I managed to track down everybody. And then after that article came out, this guy named Ben Omar, who publishes Bear Manor Books, and he's published like four of my books, I think. Four of my books. And he said, do you think you can make this into a book? And I go, I guess so, because, you know, I had just done a couple quick interviews. I didn't do, and I had only contacted Buck, really. And so I said, well, I can see what I can do. At least I could, like, pad it with, like, pictures or something. But it turned out I actually was able to interview 8 people, which actually, and then, you know, more recently, I've interviewed more people that, you know, if I ever revised the book, I found some people that I thought were actually dead, which is kind of sad. You know, but I got them on tape, so if I ever revise the book, you know, they gave me some more information. But, you know, basically, in a nutshell, General Mills, the cereal company, wanted to go into television. It was different than the way it is now with kids' shows. It's never a product saying, I need a TV show to get on TV. It's usually the networks now saying, we need a show, and we're going to sell ads on it. So it's completely the opposite. The advertiser never calls the shots anymore, but back then they did. And so General Mills wanted to get into cartoons. They initially hooked up with Jay Ward Productions and Rocky and Bullwinkle. And then Rocky and Bullwinkle, they were doing stories about sending them to the moon and, you know, doing all this stuff that was kind of like spy espionage, kind of, it's, you know, they disguised it as Potsylvania, but it's like Russia and all that stuff. And they go, this right. is supposed to be a kid's show. Why are they doing all this stuff? And so they contacted Buck, and he was working at the advertising agency, which is called Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample. And which is now Saatchi and Saatchi, if you know your ad agencies, it doesn't matter. But anyway, he said, do you think you could do a cartoon show? And they thought about it. Now, here's where the connection comes in. You were saying, you know, these are the same guys that did Coco Puffs. Well, Joe Harris, the guy who was eventually their animator, he created the Trix Rabbit. And he worked on those cereal commercials back then. And so it was just natural for them to kind of use their animation skills and writing skills for commercials and apply it to cartoons. And some things they were kind of stuck with doing, and this is how they got connected with Jay Ward even stronger, is General Mills and Dancer Fitzgerald Sample says, you must use Gamma Productions. It's a Mexican, you know, it was an early form of outsourcing. Now all cartoons are done in Korea or wherever, you know, but you know, back then it was weird to do cartoons out of the country. And they said, we set this operation up in Mexico City, you're going to do it. And so they had no choice, but whereas Jay Ward kind of badmouthed the whole thing. Oh, the Mexican situation is horrible, blah, blah, blah. The people at Total Television, they thought they were great. They thought, oh, these guys do a good job, you know. So, yeah, different opinion.
Well, definitely, you know, I mean, the cost definitely influenced their opinion, I'm sure, too. They're like, hey, you know what, this costs a lot less. They're doing a great job.
Right. And so getting to Commander McBragg, how that happened is what General Mills would do is after a few years of a particular show, they just suddenly say, oh, we have enough episodes, create something new. So this is around 1962 or 3 or something, and Rocky and Bullwinkle had been on in some form or another, either as the Bullwinkle Show or Rocky and His Friends or something, for about 5 years. And so they're telling Jay Ward, come up with something new. And, you know, since they dumped Rocky and Bullwinkle, that basically ended Bullwinkle's Corner and Mr. Know-It-All, which were those little poetry segments and the little inventor segments or whatever, that were like a minute and a half. And so General Mills said, we need like a little short segment that'll fit that minute and a half spot. And they didn't give it to Jay Ward, which is kind of strange. They gave it to Total Television. And so Total Television came up with Commander McBragg. They used that old actor, which escapes me at the top of my head. I'll reference my own book while I'm saying it. was in The Four Feathers, and they used C. Aubrey Smith. He's a British actor. He has very bushy eyebrows. And, you know, they just kind of based it on, like, the Baron Munchausen, tall tale type of attitude. It's like, I have this great story to tell you, you know, and it's like, you know, and then the other guy always said, really, sir, I must be going. And he goes, and he grabs him and he tells him some outlandish tale. And, of course, the guy listens at that point. And, you know.
Easily my favorite part of the Rocky Bullwinkle Show when I would grow up and watch those reruns, I would just be like insanely just enamored and enthralled by Commander McBragg. And I think it was one of the first things that I got, like, as a joke when I was real young, that was, like, maybe for somebody a little older. And I was like, ha-ha, that guy's lying, and he doesn't want to hear the story. And I was, like, 5, so I thought it was brilliant. You know, I was like, I figured out humor. I still got a caller on the line if you want to talk to Sean Clancy tonight, who's called in to ask you a little bit about the Casper DVD.
Okay.
Hey, Mark. How you doing, Mark and Sean?
How are you?
Hey, man, I actually honestly don't know the answer to this, but back in 2011, the complete series of Casper, The Friendly Ghost, came out on DVD set with Cliff McMillan as the producer. What was your involvement in that? Because I thought I saw your name also on that box set. What was the capacity of your involvement on that?
I actually did quite a bit on that. I did some commentaries on a few of the cartoons themselves, some by myself and some where I'm talking to. I talked to, like, Edmé Wright, and who was the widow of Cy Wright. You probably know that, I think, because of other interviews you've done, who was the co-creator of Casper. I talked to Bradley Bulkey, who also did the voice of Chumley over at Total Television, but he did the voice of the Ghostly Trio on that show. And I talked to Allison Arngrim, who is the daughter of Norman McMillan, who did the voice Casper on that show. And then they also did a little bit of a documentary, like a 15-minute documentary about Casper on there, and I'm on camera there, you know, blathering away about Casper and everything else. So, you know, my little claim to fame, you know, on that. And then I did the same for Total Television with Tennessee Tuxedo and Underdog, so... That was my Shout Factory connection. So, yeah, I am on there. Oh, I also wrote the booklet on the Casper thing, too. And I identified where the cartoons came from in the comic books and everything like that. So
they contacted you to try to get you involved in that DVD set? Or were you just helping them out?
I'm trying to think if they contacted me. Because here's how that kind of started. I wanted to do a commentary. And I was watching, like, the Looney Tunes Golden Collection. And I know a lot of people that have done those commentaries, like Jerry Beck and stuff like that. And I was asking, how do you get to do these commentaries? And Jerry Beck, you know, just kind of said, you usually have to be asked. You know, it's like you don't just get it. You know, you can't just call up and say, hi, I'd like to do a commentary. And strangely enough, when the Shout Factory thing came along, I guess because of my connections with my books, I think it was they called me for the Underdog one first. And then when I talked to him for a bit, then, you know, I found out they were doing the Casper one, and so I ended up doing the 3. And since there's kind of an overlap with some of the people, like Bradley Bulkey was on both Tennessee Tuxedo and Casper, and Allison Arngrim was both on the Underdog and Casper. You know, they thought, oh, great, you know, we can have some crossover here and get three of them done all at once. So that's how that works. So.
Three birds, one stone.
Right. Yeah.
So did they use all the commentary that you did, or did they actually edit out portions that they, did they use everything you gave them?
Pretty much everything that they gave me. I mean, they added, like, if I flubbed a word or something like that, but they were done basically live on the fly. I did half of them here. I'm in Saratoga, California. Half of them here, and then half of them up in Portland, Oregon, because the producer lived up there, and so he came down to my house, and we did half of them, and then I went up to his house to do the other half of them. So it was like two full-day sessions. Maybe the second one took 2 days. So, you know, it's like, and they were done really basically live. You know, we'd call the person up and say, you have to be available. And the person, most people are on the East Coast or in L.A., and they say, you have to be on, you know, you have to be on at this exact time, you know. And we'd watch the cartoon in real time. Most of the cartoons are like 5 minutes long, but and then some are longer, like Tennessee Tuxedo, some of those are like 10 minutes long. And you basically just have to kind of keep talking. And we kind of had it kind of pre-rehearsed. I mean, they knew what questions they were going to get. But there was a little bit of flush room so I could ask a couple extra questions. But they didn't want it to be like, and they'd given the cartoon in advance so they could take a look at it so they knew what they were talking about, because I tended to pick cartoons that were kind of historically significant. And, you know, these guys that did the voices or something, they hadn't seen these things since they did them. If they ever saw them, they did the job
right,
like 50 years ago. Yeah. So, like Bradley Bulkey, using him as an example, you know, he actually told me off the recording, he says, you know, I'm glad they sent me copies of the cartoons. I've never seen these. You know, I recorded this in 1962, and I did it in about a six-week session, and that was it, you know, or something like that. I forgot exactly how long it took, but it was very quick. They did 26 shorts, and that was it.
So you got to select the episodes, then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I got to select the episodes. A couple of them ran a little bit long, so, you know, they just chopped it shorter, so, and they wanted it to be that way. So if, like, the cartoon was 5 minutes, I talked for, like, 7 minutes. Now, if I listen to my own commentary, they did really good edits. So, I can't remember if it was anything that important that was cut out. And usually it's cutting out me, not the guest. So,
right.
Yeah.
The important
stuff.
Well,
cool. Yeah, great show, Dean. That was all I had for him. So keep up that.
I appreciate you calling in, Sean.
Yeah, great show.
Thank you, man.
Keep going,
man. No problem. I appreciate you calling in. You're always welcome. Sean Clancy, good friend of the show. He and I have a few chats here and yon on the Facebook. That's how he contacted me tonight before he called in. Facebook.com/ComptonAfterDark. And you know, I mean, that's just amazing to get a little behind the scenes of how those commentaries work, because that was actually one of the things that I was asked through the email, was like, you know, how, you know, do you just talk, blah, blah, blah. You know, and people are always amazed being in, you know, I'm in television. They're always amazed by the behind-the-scenes stuff. But I wonder if you're like me at this point where, like, somebody comes into where I work and they're like, oh, this is great. I'm like, yeah, this is where I work. You know, like, this is how it works, you know. And you try not to be blasé to them, because they're amazed and you want to, you know, engender that. But at the same time, you're like, I've seen this.
Yeah. Interesting doing those things. I mean, looking back on it, you know, I actually have the Casper one in front of me because I, you know, for this book, and I'll give a plug to Sean because he's a good guy. He's actually
great
helping
guy.
Me with some of the interviews for the Harvey book that I'm working on. He gave me a few interviews of people I had never spoken with before that worked, like, in the production department and stuff like that. How'd you track these guys down, Sean? And he goes, I don't know. You know, no, he had a reason, you know, but, like, you know, he had these really long interviews, and I'm going through them now. It's like, wow, you know. So, you know, that'll be in the book, you know, things like that. So, you know, he's helping me out.
You know,
going back to
he's helped me out a lot, too, because he's very encouraging as far as this show. He's been a big supporter of the show from day one. So I want to just give a little shout-out as well to Sean Clancy, who has, you know, always told me that my interviews or conversations, as I prefer to have, you know, call them, are twice as good as they actually are. So I appreciate you, Sean.
And he's very knowledgeable about a lot of different things, I guess, like I am. You know, especially Archie. You know, it's like he was. I know he helped Craig Gill in that Archie book too, and you know, different things. And you know, he always seems to come up with something that, you know, nobody's ever found, which is very helpful. You know, it's like, you know, I try to do that too. And sometimes I hit the jackpot. Sometimes I come up, you know, nothing. Yeah. So,
that's the way it happens when you spin the roulette wheel. That's just how it goes. I'm going to think we got to cut away for another break. Okay. Oh, sorry. Go on. Well, let me get your last thought in, and then we'll cut away.
No, cut away. No, you know, because it's going to be a longer thought.
<Go ahead. laughs> No problem, Mark. No problem. Talking here with Mark Arnold tonight, we've talked a lot about Harvey Comics. We're going to come back on the other side of this break, get this imminent thought, and then we'll talk a little Cracked and even a little Beatles, which, as everyone out there knows, that's old Dean Compton's favorite band. You want to be a part of this tonight? 855-VOC-RADIO, 855-862-7234. Compton After Dark on VOC Nation. It's worldwide, folks. Worldwide.
Right here, right now, you better recognize that I am down with the VOC Nation. Recognize that.
Hey guys, Brady Hicks here, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributing writer and the host of In the Room, thebradyhicks.com, and for the first time ever, VOCNation.com. So happy to be part of the family. Join us each and every Tuesday night, 9, 8 central, VOCNation.com, thebradyhicks.com, myself, DJ, Derek McDonald, Ray Bogus, Anthony Sarlo, Kathy Fitz, breaking down all that's going on in wrestling today, and so much more.
Okay, Philadelphia parents, listen up. Do you have a child in the house that's just about to learn how to drive? Well, you got to do this. You got to head over to DuncanSchoolOfDriving.com. Best of Bucks County 2013. Keep that insurance down. Keep them accident-free. 215-639-1990. They're endorsed by the Pennsylvania Police Officers Association, DuncanSchoolOfDriving.com.
Business owners, prepare to take charge. Get the latest trends in business and technology every Tuesday at 12 p.m. Eastern, presented by NetCarrier. Tweet your business questions in advance at NetCarrier using the hashtag TakeChargeTuesday or call live toll-free at 1-855-VOC-RADIO.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed. The entire building has just collapsed as if a demolition team set off. When you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself and it is not.
We are live with Carmine Confidential.
From Dallas, Texas, the Flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
Listen to Carmine Confidential. Weekdays at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. VOC Nation Radio Network.
Hey, I'm the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, telling you fans worldwide to visit VOCNation.com. VOC Nation gives you top-notch interviews, insightful blogs, and, of course, the VOC Wrestling Nation radio program. The VOC Wrestling Nation radio program is live every Wednesday with the hottest guests, the latest news, and lots of fun from the greatest team in wrestling media headed by the voice of choice. Hey, take it from me, the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. VOCNation.com is the place to go, baby.
Hola, hola, hola. I am Shelly Funtime Martinez.
And I am Dazzling Danielle.
And together we are
the Martinez Girls.
Tune in on VOC Nation at 7 p.m. Eastern every Saturday. And until then, Danielle, I and you are Audi 5000. Adios, toodles.
the godless voice of Crab Nation. None of these assholes would have the balls to say any of this to anyone live.
I get hard as one of them stones. I'm going to hurl at a homosexual.
He's got 6 ounces of weed, and he's saving his roaches?
Bangable and diabetic.
Park the car keys
to Stevie Wonder.
Free speech zone should just be the air, motherfucker. Catch the crowds on Crab Nation Live weekdays.
Noon to 2 p.m. Pacific, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern on the VOC Nation.
Entertainment with an attitude.
Fear is just one enemy.
This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us through the break. You know, when you hear the Violent Femmes. Compton After Dark's return from another commercial break. I'm Dean Compton, live with you here on VOC Nation Worldwide. Check out some of the other great shows you got here on VOCNation.com. Tommy Fierro's Who Slamming Who on Thursday night. Shelly Martinez, the Martinez Girls, doing podcasts throughout the week. The best wrestling podcast live radio show in the game today, In the Room with Brady Hicks, Tuesday nights. And, of course, Hangar 18 precedes our show, conservative political talk. Maybe one day I'll get around to doing a little left-wing political talk to balance things out here on VOC Nation, but I'm so busy right now. For instance, I'm busy tonight talking with Mark Arnold, noted comic book historian, contributor to Back Issue Magazine, writer of the Harvey Companion coming out early next year. And you had a thought that got cut off, unfortunately, due to having to pay a few bills with a break. So why don't we pick up where we left off, Mark?
Okay. What was my thought? I was talking about those commentaries in general. Looking back on it, they're very nerve-wracking to do. And, you know, when you listen to one, you know, I'm sure you've listened to commentaries on feature films and everything like that. I was just doing commentaries on, like, five-minute cartoons. You know, it's like, and some of these people, like, the director talking for an hour and a half throughout an entire film saying, oh, this scene, I did this and this scene. You know, that's a lot. You know, to sit there and, like, go through your entire film and have something interesting to say. You know, I've heard some really bad commentaries where there's just, like, these long blank spots where people are just, like, watching things and stuff like that. But, yeah, that's the thing I remember about being very nerve-wracking, that you had to kind of know what you're saying and, you know, be quick on the draw and stuff like that.
Absolutely. It ain't that different from doing a two-hour radio show every Sunday night. Yeah. People are always like, how are you going to fill all that time? And I said, well, by being the debonair, charming gentleman that I am and being really nice to guests, that's how I'm going to fill this time. And then I'll get them to tell me stories. And you know what? It works out. We got a lot of great stories out of you tonight. And I kind of want to shift gears here, Mark, and talk a little bit about your books on Cracked Magazine. Particularly because I know you talked a lot to Mort Todd, and actually you called in when we interviewed him. A great show, and thanks for your call. You really added some sizzle to that steak we were bringing. I mean, for real, I mean it. It's a good call. And we always like callers, 855-VOC-RADIO, 855-862-7234, because a guy like you or a guy like Sean Clancy can just put that extra on a good conversation. Talked a lot with Mort Todd. And I want to talk to you about, you know, I want you to tell me about, you know, your familiarity with Cracked Magazine and how you got into writing these books, and also how you're going to work with Mort Todd again on the Charlton Arrow, because you are actually writing about, a text article in Arrow number 3, right, about Sick Magazine by the aforementioned Joe Simon.
Yes. Well, when I started collecting comics, it was probably like in the early 70s or something like that. And it was actually my sister who found like a Mad Super Special and had Don Martin posters. And I thought that was the craziest artwork I'd ever seen. And I instantly was hooked on Mad. And we bought the thing and brought it home. And my dad said, oh, I read Mad when it was a comic book. And I was like, well, where are they? And he says, oh, I threw them out. I was like, thanks, Dad. So, anyway, you know, at the time, Crack was on the stands, Marvel had Crazy, and Sick was still being published, but around the early 70s, it was actually kind of hard to find. So I never saw that till later. But Mad was one of those things. It was so good then, you know, and, you know, it's like everything else. But Mad, well, only came out 8 times a year. I say only. It's only 6 times a year now, but you got a lot of other things to look at on the Internet. But back then, you know, to get your humor fix, you know, it was every 6 weeks. And even on the back of the book, Dan Klaus talks about that. He says, you know, you couldn't wait the 6 weeks, and so you'd go and buy a crack, and then you'd get disappointed again. Why did I buy crack? I hate crack. I'm never going to buy this again. You know, I use that quote on the back of the book because it is true. Crack was always kind of a second-rate book, and, you know, there's a few fans out there, if they're listening, they all know, you know, it's like, I know people do like cracked, you know, but and some people prefer it over Mad. Yes. I have to say I still prefer Mad. But, you know, when Mort Todd took it over, cracked was really good then. And but one of the things that was the mainstay in cracked always was John Severin's artwork. And I would buy cracked for a while, and then I'd stop. And I'd buy it for a while, and then I'd stop. And then later on, as I got to be an adult, because I never quit buying these things, I decided to go and fill in the gaps. And, you know, thankfully things like eBay came along, because you go to comic book stores, they never carried old issues of cracked. You know, that was garbage.
Right.
And so, you know, in the early days of eBay, I started to say, you know, people would offer them for, like, nothing. And so I bought, like, all the old issues for, like, nothing, you know, stacks of them. And so, again, talking about Bear Manor Media, after the Underdog book came out, or Total Television book came out, we were just brainstorming about the next book to do. And I had mentioned some earlier conversation that I had every issue of Cracked Magazine. And he said, and then so in this later conversation, he says, why don't you do a history of Cracked Magazine? And I literally said, does anyone care? You know,
I'm one of the people who actually, I like Cracked more. I know Matt is better, but I like Cracked more, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. So, but I was one of those people, it's like, to me, it was like a total guilty pleasure. I bought Crazy Magazine, and nobody liked that, you know, and I still liked it.
At least not after Gerber was off of it.
Yeah, I'm talking about the later ones, you know. And,
yeah.
You know, the one thing that's happened, which I don't know if this has happened with you doing this show or anything else, is you interview people that when you're young you can't stand for whatever reason. Oh, I can't stand that artist, or I can't stand that writer. I don't know why he's doing this. You know, why did they fire this guy? You know, I won't mention names.
Right.
But, you know, in doing the Cracked book, you know, I put a feeler out on Facebook, and I said, does anybody care? And I started getting inundated with, like, email. Oh, I worked there. Oh, my friend worked there. Oh, yeah, I know somebody that worked there. I love Cracked. And it's like, okay, I guess I'll do it. And then there's a few key people I wanted to get. And one of them was Severin. And then one of them was Paul Lakin. And I wanted to get, I wanted to get Sproul's son, because I knew Bob Sproul, the original publisher, was gone. And I wanted to get Mort Todd, and I wanted to get Lou Silverstone. I figured, you know, those kind of basically the eras of it. And I ended up interviewing like 60 people, and there's a lot more I could have interviewed. You know, it's just that, you know, there's only so much room and so much space. But I really wanted, you know, like, Paul Lakin was like the equivalent of John Severin on the writing end, you know, and he never got the credit. You know, he actually edited practically every black and white humor magazine that ever came out, except for Mad, over the years, and he even wrote for Mad. He was one of the original two. He was one of the original two writers for Mad that got hired after Kurtzman took everybody and went to do Trump and Humbug and Help and all that stuff. And Al Feldstein, the new editor, had to put an ad in the New York Times saying, hey, we need some writers here, and we need some artists, we need somebody. And so he answered it to the New York Times. And so Paul Aiken was either the first, he didn't remember at the time, he was the first or second writer that Feldstein hired, the other being Frank Jacobs, who still writes for Mad today. So, So I got Paul Lakin. I wasn't even sure if Paul Lakin was around. Now, unfortunately, he has passed away now. But at the time, I thought, in fact, one of the people I interviewed said he was. And I go, oh, darn, you know, because he had edited Crack twice. He had written a number of issues and stuff like that. And it's like, I just always kind of wanted to talk to him. Then I found out he was still around. He was actually very coherent and everything else like that. And so I got a really good interview. And then a couple of years after the book came out, he did pass away, unfortunately. But it happens to everybody.
At least you were able to get his story, though, Ben. You didn't just you know, take that gentleman's word for it and be like, oh, well, I'll never get him. And, you know, you recorded his story for, you know, posterity's sake. Because, like you say, Crack this scene is kind of the, it's seen as inferior to Matt. And I think for a lot of times maybe it wasn't as good. But there's still that love for it. And it still deserves its own story being told. And I'm glad you were able to get that done. And you wound up with two books worth of material. That's insane.
Yeah, well,
you say you could have had more?
You say that again?
You wound up with two books of material, but you also said you could have had more. That's what's insane.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a long story. I mean, it's like, you know, some people do quibble about having an index in the back of the book, you know. But it's actually been very helpful to me and other people. After they use the index, they go, "Wow, that's really helpful. I can find something," you know, because, you know, there isn't anything like that. And people say, "Well, why don't you put it on the internet?" Well, I can put anything on the internet. You know, I don't have to publish books. I could just do it all for free. Get all this research, and,
Don't go that way. I'm doing the show. I don't get paid anything to do the show. That's not the way to go. Get paid.
You know, I still like books. I'm sorry. I'm a little old school. It's like, yeah, all my books, except for my initial Harvey one, which there's just formatting issues with that one, which is why that one isn't. All my other books are in ebook format. But do I look at them on ebook? Yeah, sometimes. But I just like picking up the hard copy book and flipping through it. You know, that's just the way I am. Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Totally with you on. Yeah, I said I'm totally with you on book.
Yeah,
you know, I definitely prefer hard copy, especially for history stuff.
Yeah, and you know, the thing I learned on the Crack thing is a lot of the people worked for MAD that worked at Crack, and you know, I know that was Mort Todd's thing to do, is to try to poach MAD, and got Don Martin over and a few others, you know. But it's like, prior to him doing it, a lot of people just either came from or went to MAD anyway, you know. It's so, it's kind of one of the funniest stories is I talked to both Al Jaffe and Angelo Torres, and neither of them remembered working for Crack ever. Yeah, and I had to send them scans of the pages they did. They go, oh, I guess I did. But I can kind of understand why they forgot, because neither of them did it more than a handful of issues. And, Torres, you know, he did a handful of issues, and then he went on to SICK, and he worked at SICK for about 10 years before he went to MAD. So he was, like, one of their mainstays, so he remembers SICK very well. Jaffe, he went with Kurtzman to Trump and Humbug, and I don't know if you know the story about Humbug, but Kurtzman's Humbug, they pooled their own money in and published it themselves, and I think they published it through Charlton, but they still put their own money into it, and when it went belly up, they don't even say this in the Humbug book, but Bill Elder, Jack Davis, and Al Jaffe immediately went to Cracked, because they needed to keep working. You know, they didn't have anywhere else to go. And they couldn't go back to MAD because they all had bailed away. Eventually, they all did go back to MAD. But, you know, it's like, Jaffe went pretty quickly back to MAD, you know, after that. It took a while, like the mid-60s, to get Davis back. And then finally, Elder and Kurtzman came back, actually, after Feldstein retired, you know, but they did come back, so everybody comes back to MAD, I guess, but...
Seems that way.
And then, you know, the current editor of MAD, John Ficarri, he doesn't like to talk about it, but he worked at Cracked. And
is there any reason he doesn't want to talk about it? I mean, is it just because he doesn't feel like it's a pro thing to do while he's the current owner of Mad?
I don't know. He was one of, I have to say this, he was one of the few people that did turn me down for an interview, and I was kind of disappointed because, you know, I wasn't going to grill him on it. I was just kind of curious about it. But, you know, admittedly, he didn't work at Crack very long, but, you know, the fact, you know, I just find it ironic that, you know, he's been editor of Mad for like, or co-editor since 1985, you know, so, you know,
wow.
I think his job's pretty secure at Mad, so he could talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
It would seem so. He certainly survived a lot of corporate upheaval in that time.
No. But I did meet him in San Diego one year, and he was very nice. You know, he just didn't want to talk about it for my book, and it was fine. Okay. You know, so.
Yeah, his prerogative, certainly. I mean, I get turned down for the show. It happens.
Yeah. So, but I didn't leave that fact out that he actually worked for Crack, you know, so.
Tell me about working with Mort Todd now, because is there maybe a surreal feeling to it, having, like, interviewed him, you know, for the Crack books, learning about the history of Crack magazine, but now you kind of work with him on the Charlton Arrow because, you know, like we said, you're doing a, a text piece on Sick.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, like, you know this. You make friendships from doing these interviews sometimes, and you keep talking to people. And, you know, had I known that Mort Todd was only, like, a few years older than me, you know, when he was doing Crack, you know, because back then I was a little bit, you know, shy and nervous, and I didn't do too many submittals. I mentioned my Archie submittal, but I submitted occasional things to Mad, and it never even crossed my mind to ever submit anything to Cracked. And so kind of like now, if I knew how cool Mort Todd was and is, you know, I probably would have submitted something. He might have published me back then or something.
Right.
Well, so now we're kind of making amends now because are you familiar with this magazine called Scary Monsters?
I am familiar with the magazine, but not a whole lot. You know, I've seen it and I'm aware of it, basically.
Okay, it's a magazine that's done in the style of the old Famous Monsters. It's on newsprint, and it comes out, I think, bi-monthly. It might be closer to monthly. I don't remember, but I've done a few articles for them. And since it's monster theme, of course, and Cracked has been monster themed, I wrote an article in there after my books were published, you know, kind of focusing on Cracked Monster Party and Cracked for Monsters Only and all the different monster books that they did all the years. And, you know, Mort's talked about them before. And, and Mort and I have just been talking since that book of just different things we could work on. And I, you know, I'm always encouraging him, come on, do another humor magazine. I'll contribute. And he goes, I got to do this stuff first, you know. And I understand
right.
where he's at. It's kind of like what we were saying earlier with the superhero stuff sells better than the cartoony stuff. So, you know, okay, it's the same thing here. You know, the Charlton action stuff is going to sell better than, say, you know, a new version of Sick or Cracked, you know, unfortunately, but true. So, you know, I had this article that I originally wrote, I don't even remember where I wrote it for, it'd probably come back to me if I thought about it, about Sick Magazine. Oh, I know, there's another Charlton fanzine, which is published very sporadically. And I contributed the article to him, and he says, yeah, I'll publish it in the next issue. And then different people that were working at Charlton kept passing away. So, like, every issue became a tribute issue. And he goes, sorry, dude, I'm going to have to move it to the next issue. And then it just kind of got forgotten. And so I had this article that sat around for 10 years. And I even considered putting it in the back pages of my Harvey fanzine just to have it printed somewhere. But I never printed it there either. And so when I found out Mort was doing the Charlton Arrow, I said, hey, I did an article about 10 years ago about Sick Magazine. Sick was published by Charlton for about 4 years. Would you consider it? And he goes, yeah. And so I submitted it to him as is. And he says, I love it. And then, you know, I said, well, let me look it over. And I actually had a friend of mine who's into these humor magazines look at it too, and he actually made some changes to it because you know, it had been so long that some of the things I wrote about weren't entirely correct, and so he actually made some additions and corrections to it, so it's actually more accurate. His name's Tom Smith. He's a big humor magazine collector. He lives in Canada, and he gets part of the byline because he helped me write the article, or rewrite the article, I should say. And so that's how that got in there. So
That's awesome. I can't wait to read it. I've already ordered my copy of The Arrow. Anybody out there wants to order one, MortonTodd.com is where you can find more information about that. I got an email question for you about the your cracked book. Somebody wanted to know a little bit about Steve Ditko's foreword to it. That is apparently, they said it was really funny and you know really cool. Want to know if you could talk about your interactions with him in regards to that.
Well, it is kind of jokey. Some people go, "Oh, that, come on, you just put that card on there," and I go, "Well." I felt I wouldn't do my due diligence if I didn't ask Ditko, because he did contribute with Mort Todd on the Robot Wars strip in Cracked and a few other things for Cracked. And right. I thought that I knew Ditko didn't really go to conventions. He didn't really do fan drawings. He had a little bit of a dispute about Spider-Man, stuff like that. But I figured, oh, that's Spider-Man. I won't ask him about Spider-Man. I'm asking him about Cracked. He'll talk about that, you know. And I figured, well, you know, like I said, if I didn't ask at all. And so I did get his address, and I don't remember who gave it to me or how I found it. But anyway, and I sent him, I don't think I had his phone number. So I wrote him a letter, and I didn't have an email. And he sent back that postcard that I printed in the book, and basically saying, sorry, I don't have the information you need. And, you know, since this is Cracked, I put a few jokes in there, and that one's one, you know. And it was, it, you know, if some people are like, oh, that's not really a forward, it's a joke, you know. It's,
right, right.
You know, it's like, it is a forward. It is written by Ditko, so, I mean, I really do have, you know, a handwritten postcard by him. But I didn't approach him after that. I know he will talk on occasion. If you talk to Mort Todd about Steve Ditko on a personal level, he'll talk your ear off. It's just he doesn't want to talk publicly on talk shows like we're doing or anything about anything, really, Spider-Man or anything. So, you know, again, it's like John Ficarra. I respect that, you know. But, you know, I had to put it in there.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because that is, like you said, that's total Cracked. That's exactly the feel and, you know the feel of the magazine, the way I felt when I would pick it up off the shelf, and I think that's absolutely, that's really fucking funny, in all honesty.
Yeah.
We're almost out
talk.
Of time. Oh, go on.
Okay. I was going to say,
we got time for a story.
I put the bad Cracked reviews on the back cover. They're real quotes, you know. I put that on there. Some people say, why did you do that? Because they were real quotes. You know, saying Cracked is horrible. You know, that's all I was going to say, you know. You know, and there's a few other little jokes in the book because, you know, there are things that happen during the course of making the book. It was really weird. And I go, if I'm going to do it anywhere, do it in a humor book. So it's like, you know. That's all I'm saying about that for now. We're running out of time.
No, like I said, we're just about out of time. I want to just talk to you real quick about your Beatles book because, like I said, the Beatles are my favorite band. I haven't got a chance to read your book. I have tons of Beatles books, and it's kind of weird because I'm such a Beatles fan. When I find a book or any kind of thing that I haven't seen, I'm like, ah, how did I miss this? So talk about,
yeah.
you know, your love of the Beatles and, you know, the way you did your book, because from what I understand, you actually review every single Beatles song from, you know, from I'm Down to Revolution Number 9.
Yeah, well, I review group and solo, released and unreleased, as much as I know, up to the time the book came out, which is like 3 years ago. But to make it a little different, I decided, you know, it's like I could put the standard photos and stuff like that. And then I said, I got a good idea. I'll get all my friends. I know different friends that are artists, like Patrick Owsley, I know, and Bill Morrison, I know, and stuff like that. It's like, let's see if they'll contribute artwork. And then I opened it up to anybody. So there's some fan art, and then there's some really professional art. Bill Morrison did the cover, and it's the Yellow Submarine cover. And, you know, it was just just in fun, you know, is my opinions about, you know, all these songs. And, you know, it was kind of a personal pet project that I just wanted to do. And, you know, that one I actually self-published because, you know, I talked about it to different people and they said, that's so personal, you should just do it yourself, which I did. So there we go.
That's awesome. I mean, because that kind of just speaks to the Beatles, too, because they did it themselves. They did it their own way, and it was very personal to them. So I just like – I like how it kind of just ties into that whole feel, if you ask me. Like, you're like, I'm going to get this done. It means something to me. And you did it.
Yeah. And I rate the songs. I rate the songs the way I feel. So sometimes I'll like a song that everybody else hates. And vice versa. You know, there's a song I don't like very much, you know, like one I'll mention, you know, that comes to the top of my head. Most people praise All Things Must Pass as George Harrison's best solo album. I find it a little bit overproduced. In fact, in later years, George Harrison even thought that himself. And so I don't like it as much as some of his later work, which, you know, that's just my opinion, you know. And some people are like, oh, that's sacrilege. You can't say that. You know, it's like, eh, my opinion.
Yeah. It's subjective, folks. So,
I still have the album. I still listen to it on occasion. So it's like, you know, it's not like I'm throwing it in the trash. Just get this out of here, you know.
Well, I mean, I think one of the big things with that one is just he had all those songs. I think it would be like lauded as like one of the greatest rock and roll albums in history if it wasn't a triple album.
Yeah. And I talk about that, too. You know, it's like, I go, does he really need to do the Jam album? You know, I don't know.
He can do what he wants. He's George Harrison. I mean, you know, he's forgotten more about music than I'll ever know. But from a subjective standpoint, I'm like, there's a whole lot of this.
But he wasn't the only one that did that. I mean, McCartney made some weird choices, like he did Mary Had a Little Lamb. You know, it's like,
right.
Lennon did some strange choices, you know, he did a whole album where, you know, the Sometime in New York City album is very strange, you know, and Ringo did an oldies standards album, you know, Sentimental Journey, which is kind of strange, you know, it's like, but it's all in there, you know, I don't know, like some of it, some of it's kind of like, I can't stand this, but, you know, and then there's some unreleased stuff that they've never put out that I go, why don't they put this song out, this song's great, and, you know, it's like, you know, I don't get it. And even the Beatles, to this day, there's some Beatles tracks that are still not out, and it just baffles me. I mean, I have them on bootlegs and stuff, I'll freely admit it. But if they put out a legit version, I'd buy it. You know, I'll give them more money.
Yeah. Right. No, I'm in the same boat. Unfortunately, we are, you know, just about out of time. One more time, talk about the books you have out there now. The Harvey Companion, expected late next year from Tomorrow's Publishing, but talk a little bit more about the Disney book that you have out right now.
Okay, this Disney book is out now. It's in both hard copy version, and also as an e-book. All my books are available on Amazon, so they're pretty easy to find. You just type it in. The title of it is Frozen in Ice, so if you type Frozen in Ice and Mark Arnold, it'll probably pop right up, along with all
Absolutely.
The Frozen CDs. That was not intentional. I did not know they were going to call their next film Frozen. I really didn't, you know. And it's like, and then that came out. Like, okay, free publicity. I don't care. And I was like,
right. How serendipitous.
Say that again?
I said, how serendipitous.
Yes, it's how serendipitous, correct. So, and, yeah, there's the Think the Patty Freeling story, didn't talk too much about that, but it's about the history of Pink Panther and the Aardvark and all the cartoons that they made. I interviewed quite a few people. It's in production, so it should come out early 2015 if I'm on schedule. So that's the other one. That one comes up from Bear Manor. And those are the main ones.
So much. I didn't even get to half the stuff I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I know.
We'll have you on again so you can talk about it. You're a great guest.
Oh, thank you very much. And that's about it.
Yeah, that's what we got for this week. I really appreciate you, Mark Arnold, coming on here. Everybody go to Amazon.com, type in Mark Arnold, great stuff. Like two books on Cracked, Total Television book. You really can't go wrong. Mark, we'll definitely have you on here again sometime. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time tonight. Next week, we'll have Jason Caskey after he got caught up in the big flood in Iowa. He has recovered. He'll be here next week. He's supposed to have been here last week, but everything's going well for him now. And we'll talk about Holy Terror and his Vengeance Squad story coming up in the Charlotte Arrow. This is Dean Compton. This has been Compton After Dark on the VOC Nation Worldwide.